Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's a serendipitous coincidence that a distinguished member of the UCSD faculty happens to have a family connection to tonight's speaker. Peter Gurevich, a professor of political science at UCSD and the founding dean of UCSD's Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Rim Studies, has done us the honor of introducing a number of past speakers in this series, such as economist Paul Krugman and anthropologist Jared Diamond just earlier this year. Please join me now in welcoming Professor Gurevich, who will provide the introduction for this evening's speaker. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. So, yes, Philip and I are related, and you have noticed that we do not pronounce our names in the same way. We share a great-grandfather. Our father is a first cousin, so we're second cousins. I know when I came to San Diego, most of my friends could not imagine that they would ever meet another person with the same last name. They thought that was sufficiently unique. And let me tell you, there's lots of us. But we've got left like confusing by pronouncing it differently. Philip's version is more accurate to the Russian origins of the name. In Russia, it would be Gurevich. But this is America, so we can do anything we want. And before Philip became famous, I could never get people to understand my name when I was making a reservation. So usually I made reservations as Peter. But I've discovered in the last 10 years that it's pretty easy. I just say Gurevich or Gurevich, and they get it right away. So it's one of Philip's many contributions to my life is that. But more important than our name is Philip's work. His books, his writings in The New Yorker, his editing of the Paris Review, his activities and lectures and speeches, they've all combined to make him an important public intellectual. And I think that's an important thing in our world, is having people who take big themes and topics, write about them, and come and talk about them in audiences like this. And what fascinates me about Philip's work, what impresses me tremendously about it, is his ability to mix a good story, character, individuals with big philosophical issues. He has the writer's feel for an individual person, and I was talking to him earlier. He likes to talk to people and find out what their story is and what their version of events is, and you can see that in his writing. He conveys the personalities and the people, but then he locates it in a very, very big set of questions about it. So he challenges us, and he takes disturbing topics and themes, the Rwandan massacres, Abu Ghraib, and he asks difficult questions, not only what happened to these people and how do they understand these events, but why they happen and what happens. And I think he's also brilliant in challenging conventional understandings. The Rwanda book, which has the extraordinary title, "We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families, Stories from Rwanda." I think the thing that he challenges brilliantly there is a very important debate that we have, which is why do these terrible conflicts between peoples happen? And there's a debate about what's called the primordial hypothesis versus the situational one. The primordial one is that there's these ancient hatreds, people hate each other, give them an opportunity, and they'll kill each other. And Philip challenges that. The Tutsi and Hutus were not spending centuries killing each other. They were living side by side quite well. It was a distinction not very well known. Didn't exist, and it was encouraged by the Belgian colonizers and then developed in other reasons. So it was a situation that happened. It was not some primordial thing. You have to understand the situation. And I think what Philip does brilliantly is convey that across by telling stories. One of them, which is his story, many of you have seen the movie, the Hotel Rwanda movie. That character featured in that movie is a person, Philip was the first person to interview him and tell his story. And it's described in this book, and then a movie was made out of that character that Philip had identified. So an important theme of the Rwanda book is that responsibility is widely shared amongst the many people around the world who didn't do anything to stop that massacre. The new book, Standard Operating Procedure, co-authored by Philip with Errol Morris, with a movie, which is not yet showing in San Diego, so you can't have seen it. There, I think he confronts, in telling that story, he confronts a very common theory, which is that pictures speak louder than words. We've all seen these pictures about that, and many people have thought, well, it's very obvious what happened, that these soldiers were doing these things and they were enjoying it, and that somehow that's normal and that stuff happens. And I think the book very brilliantly dissects and unravels that and punctures our ability to make that story. I think Philip will tell this himself. Why is this girl smiling is not at all obvious and needs to be understood. And so he constructs it out of telling their stories. But he also does a brilliant job in that book, I think, in reconstructing the frame of how it was they were permitted to do this, how it happened that their superiors were not preventing from happening and allowing it. And he does a remarkable job tracing back to the very highest levels of authority, all Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, the president, all these people, putting a frame on, well, these were terrorists and you can do anything you want to terrorists, that none of the conventional laws and rules need apply. It's the people lower down took the heat. They got the punishment. The people on the top who made that situation possible did not get punished. So Philip tells very compelling stories. You get drawn by the stories of these individuals into trying to understand them. And then as a terrific writer, he takes you into the larger framework. What did it mean? Why are you reading this story? What are you supposed to learn about it? What are you supposed to think about the world? So terrific writers, he writes books that mix literature, people and character with larger context, politics, and moral choices. So it's with great pride and pleasure that I get to introduce a family member. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Philip Gurevich.
Thank you, Peter. I always thought the turning point in when one could get reservations and so forth was when the agriculture minister of the Soviet Communist Party became premier. And I remember going to a restaurant where we had a reservation and hearing the maitre d' shouting out, "Gorbachev, table for Gorbachev." And we realized that's us. Nobody stepped between us and that table, so it worked. Thank you all for coming out to night when it's kind of an exciting night in this country politically. We have two candidates, finally, it looks like, and to talk about or to hear about a subject that is in itself, in some ways, many ways, I think, repellent. The story of Abu Ghraib is a story that one is overwhelmingly inclined to look away from rather than look towards, which is, I think, part of what drew me to it. I was covering the 2004 presidential election for The New Yorker 4 years ago when the photographs first appeared and were broadcast on 60 Minutes and then published in The New Yorker with Cy Hirsch's reporting. And I remember not spending a whole lot of time with them. I didn't feel that I wanted to look extensively. A little glimpse got you pretty far, and thinking this changes the perception of this war. This surely will become a central aspect of this presidential year. The president himself was running for re-election and was being challenged on the merits of the war in many ways. And here was what instantaneously became a kind of iconic photograph, a set of photographs that were seen immediately by more people on Earth than probably any single event or any single set of images since the collapse of the World Trade Towers on September 11th. And in many ways seemed to me a kind of bookend to that. Here one went from the wounds that the nation had suffered on that day to the self-inflicted wounds that were starting to define the nation in its response to that event. And these images had a weird iconographical power. The picture of the man on the box hooded in that kind of crucifixion-like stature with the wires coming from his fingers, the little American woman holding what appeared to be a dog leash with a naked man on the end of it, the naked human pyramid. These things seem to come from some sort of deep dungeon landscape and a kind of horror film aesthetic almost. And they were not, and this was immediately striking, photographs taken by a photographer or professional photographer. Throughout our history, we have images that define how we understand things, whether they're verbal or whether they're pictorial. And those images invariably are made by professional image makers, by news people, by reporters, or subsequently by novelists or by filmmakers or so. And here you had the very first really major war photographs produced by the participants in the events depicted. Not just participants in the war, but these instantaneously changed our perception of who we were and what we were doing. Or so it seemed. At the time, you may recall, the cover of The Economist the next week, and The Economist, I stress, is a newspaper which, magazine, which had supported the war from the start and had defended its support of the war up until then and continued to a large degree. And its criticisms, if any, were always of the execution of the project rather than the project itself. So not what one would call the anti-war rag, had on its cover the man on the box with the wires and the hood, and the headline was Rumsfeld resign. Many newspapers made the same call. It was very widespread assumption that there was a direct correlation between the policies of the administration, the policies of the authors of the war, and the conduct of the low-level soldiers who were seen in the photographs they took of themselves humiliating, torturing, abusing prisoners in Abu Ghraib prison. And then somehow that disappeared. Part of it was that in an election year, mysteriously, there was no opposition to the president, and there was no real opposition candidate or opposition party. There wasn't an opposition party practically in Congress, so we had a period at that time of a one-party state where all the branches of government were controlled by the same party, and so investigation was virtually stillborn. You'd have a few hearings, and everybody would agree that it was best not to go too much further. And you also didn't have anybody who was saying, this is a crucial moment when the honor of the nation is at stake. These acts were made and done in the name of our security, in our names, in the name of our freedom. And if that's the case, we have to discuss if that's how we want things to be. We need to hold accountable those who think that this is how we want to be in the world. That debate never happened. It never materialized. And it seemed to me that this kind of open sore that these photographs represented was brushed aside, and instead we got diverted by the kind of soap opera element. Lindy England, the woman who was holding the leash, was having an affair with Charles Grainer, the commander of the night shift. And these people were trailer trash, and these people were, they gave them tabloid nicknames. She was Leash Girl. And Sabrina Harmon, who was one of the MPs who'd taken a lot of the pictures, was suddenly described as the girl next door, as in ghoul, G-H-O-U-L, in some of the papers. And you had Grainer ridiculed and made fun of as a kind of figure of perversity and almost fraternity house pranking. And the whole thing became diverted. And now, President Bush had said at one stage that the day that the photographs of Abu Ghraib were released, was one of the worst days of the war and of his presidency. Maybe he said the worst. And it's always struck me that that's actually one of the many false statements he's made, that in fact, it was one of the best days of his presidency in terms of his policy of abusing prisoners, because it created a tremendous diversion. And we started to pay attention only to what was in the frame of the photographs, rather than into the photographs became their own context. We started to look at the actions in there and get distracted by them and say, well, people said a photograph is worth a million words, or there you see it. The photographs are all you need to know. They tell the whole story. These phrases, by the way, you could Google them and they would come up over and over. The photographs told the whole story. Well, did they? What were we seeing? I kept thinking, I don't know what I'm looking at. And as I say, I didn't spend a lot of time dwelling on these photographs, but I felt that there was some important way in which, as documents began to get leaked in the aftermath of the Abu Ghraib photographs, as people who had been in the administration and who had been in the military started to send out documents saying, you know, this was the policy and that was the policy, and we started to get the torture memos that had been written justifying the use of torture or trying to find ways to soften and weaken the definition of torture from high-level administration lawyers in the president and the vice president's office, in the Justice Department, in the Pentagon. Then you started to get this legal story at a high level. And then down below were still the grunt soldiers, and they were starting to go to trial, the bad apples, as they were classified. And there was some sort of total disconnect between these two things. And it seemed to me that this had happened and that we were actually getting pushback. The normal concept of an exposé is that when the journalist says, ha, "We have evidence that you have been violating the foundational principles of this nation, of its laws, of its adherence to international law, all the rhetoric on which you've waged your war, and we found you guilty of perpetuating this prison system of torture in Sodom's old dungeons. You'd expect some degree of shame and denial." And you got a certain amount of denial, but what you got was blame of the lowest level possible soldier. And soldiers, and you got pushback. You got Dick Cheney saying, "Well, I don't know, it seems to me we ought to be able to give people a little dunk now and then." And that throws the whole journalistic game off. A lot of the press didn't know how to respond to that. Wait, you're not being ashamed, you're saying we ought to do it? And this pushback confused people, and it seemed to correspond, frankly, to a public mood. There was this public mood that, well, you know, if they caught us, they'd be beheading us, see? And if they had their hands on us, they'd just kill us without asking any questions. And suddenly I started to realize that what was being described was an idea that America's standard for measuring itself should be that we're just a little bit better than the terrorist enemy. And it seems to me that when you measure yourself against the standard of your enemy, you've created a standard that you can go very, very, very low before you are caught out. These photographs had caught us out against that measure, and they weren't being in some way grappled with. And I say this from personal experience, not by saying, oh, other people didn't, but because I myself also felt in some way, I can't really look at this, I don't quite know what I'm looking at, and I don't have any way to get access to this story. It's beyond me. What was happening there? And then Errol Morris, the filmmaker, started sending me these transcripts of interviews he was doing with the people who had been in the pictures and who had taken the pictures, the soldiers who had served at Abu Ghraib. Errol's a friend from a long time ago. And I had began reading these in the summer of 2006, interviews with the so-called bad apples and with other soldiers who'd been at the prison. And immediately I started to hear these voices describing a situation that had not, to me, been described before. They were the voices of ordinary American soldiers. They were voices that actually belonged to the American vernacular. And I suddenly realized this is a war story. It's a group of soldiers who had been sent with their unit into a prison where a policy was in place. That policy was to use a series of extraordinary measures that were not part of the army training or part of the tradition of this country to break prisoners under interrogation. And that as far as they were concerned, and if you think about it, when I say a war story, I mean in the way that Tolstoy would describe people in the midst of battle. I mean the way that World War I literature describes soldiers in the trenches. You are a tiny pixel in a very large picture. You and your unit go into a place you can't see very far in any direction. You don't really know what the policies are that are actually defining the events that you're in the midst of. There's the smoke and the fog of war, as people say, but there's also the sheer fear and the combat situation and the fact that all around you, the strange situation you're in is being reinforced. And I heard this from these voices, and I thought, these are voices I've never heard. And for the first time, I suddenly thought, there's a way to tell this story. And the way to tell this story is through the experience of these low-level soldiers encountering policy in action. Policy by itself can be very abstract. You can get into debates about the legal nitpicking about what exactly is the definition of torture. Back in Washington, in the aftermath of September 11th, you had lawyers at the Justice Department who took the law on torture and said, well, the law on torture seems to be premised on two basic things. One is the intent. You have to be able to show that there's an enormous intent to inflict pain, that all the pain that is suffered is the consequence of a deliberate intent to suffer that degree of pain. What degree of pain? That's the other part. It has to be extreme pain. Well, how extreme? They decided to take a term from the actuarial literature of insurance companies, and they came up with the term to define the pain and torture as pain equivalent to that of organ failure or death, which is to say unknowable pain, because the only people who've ever experienced it are dead. And therefore, it's very difficult to prove, let's say, on the witness stand, that you've experienced it, because you're alive. And so they dismissed, they sort of de-defined torture. And they decriminalized it, because the real concern was that torture under the international statutes and their criminal correlatives in this country, in the criminal code, torture is has criminal sanctions and is a criminal law. And the concern was, well, if people torture, can it be somehow nailed to the president, if the president basically legitimizes certain practices? How do we know that that's what they were worried about? Because in the memoranda that came out of Gonzalez's legal shop, and he was then the White House counsel, this is before he became attorney general, he was addressing the question of special counsels. And special counsels are appointed specifically only to prosecute presidents. They're not appointed to prosecute secretaries of defense or something like that. So it was clear that they were looking at that. Now, there's a whole other level, which is cruel, degrading, and inhuman treatment of prisoners or captives. Now, that does not carry criminal sanctions. And so they weren't so concerned with being cruel, degrading, or inhuman. But they nevertheless looked at how do you look at the limits of this. And they thought, well, there are no cases in American law to cite as precedent. Let's go to European law or international law. They don't have a lot of regard for international law, but they thought it was important to take a look. And they found that it wasn't just America that liked to do these things from time to time, that if you looked at it, there was an important case, which was Ireland versus England, which went back to the IRA days, and it was heard at the European Court of Human Rights in The Hague. And, of course, I don't need to tell you that to the Bush administration's view, the European Court of Human Rights is about as sort of soft and lefty and French as you can get. And you look at that, and these guys said that keeping people in stress positions on tippy toes, holding their body weight against their fingertips for hours on end while loud music is blasted at them and they're in hoods, in states of undress, did not attain the level of pain that constitutes torture. So they said, look, the Israeli Supreme Court, which has been tough on torture, did not think that similar things attained torture. So they're saying, there really doesn't seem to be much to worry about here. And it's very easy to be put off by this. But I think if, in fact, you're troubled by what you see in the Abu Ghraib pictures and by the movement of this, our national policy towards a policy of torture, it's worth understanding that the weaknesses that they identified in the law are real weaknesses. Those are not weaknesses they invented. Those are weaknesses they found. And what lawyered-up people who are looking to make trouble do is they find weaknesses in the law. The other law that they looked at very closely was the Geneva Convention, and they found another set of weaknesses, because the Geneva Convention is, in fact, inadequate to the war that we are now fighting, the war that the administration has defined as the global war on terror. And this is where, to some extent, in looking at this, I start to part company with people who think, well, if only we could just restore adherence to the Geneva Convention, everything would be fine. What the administration basically said, the administration's lawyers, was if you look closely at the Geneva Convention, 90% of its protections, and the Geneva Convention is a set of conventions that largely define international protocols for the treatment of prisoners during wartime, people captured from the other side. And it's, again, we can look at it as some sort of international law that's external to our country and not part of our sovereign tradition. That's false, because American military doctrine embraces the Geneva Convention, bases itself on the Geneva Conventions, and actually states in the suitable field manual and army regulations, it states in events where a conflict is seen between army doctrine and the Geneva Convention shall prevail. That's very powerful language. It means that the army's doctrine, its legal doctrine, subordinates itself to these conventions. They are the highest authority. And what do they say? They basically are very, very, very detailed about what's pertinent and what the rights and respects that are to be afforded to prisoners are in what, broadly speaking, could be called a conventional war, a war between two nation states. What does that mean? A war between two armies, each of which belongs to a sovereign political body. So the war that we fought against Saddam Hussein is such a war. He is a sovereign. He has an army. His army acts not because of their individual impulses, but because they serve their political entity. What did the administration do? The first war that they waged after September 11th, the beginning of the war on terror, is the Afghanistan war. And shortly after that began, within 2 or 3 months, Bush issued a declaration that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to the entire theater. This was something very new. It had never been declared before. And it was based on the idea that neither the Taliban nor Al-Qaeda, who were our two obvious main enemies there, are the armies of a state. They are stateless. They are unlawful combatants in the lingo that was coined for this. They are not covered by the Geneva Conventions. And there was a real debate within the administration. Gonzalez wrote a memorandum, mostly because Colin Powell said, this is outrageous, we can't do this, we're going to get slaughtered for it. And Gonzalez wrote a memorandum saying, well, here are the things that are the pros and here are the cons. The pros were, you know, streamlines things and we can do whatever we want. And the cons were, well, you know, people could do this to us. Bad for American soldiers. Other countries could say, well, America did it, so we're going to do it too. It could radically diminish our prestige in international eyes and make us look no better than other enemies. A list that was pretty persuasive. And he said, but those are minor concerns. I think we should do it. And so they did it. And that created for them a kind of permission slip. The combination of the removal of Geneva coverage and the erosion of the torture law to sort of define it out of existence. There is no such thing as torture because you can never prove it. And Geneva doesn't apply, created the possibility for what they called enhanced, robust, aggressive interrogation techniques. Many of the memoranda that have come out use much simpler language. The gloves are coming off, gentlemen. The idea then was first seen in action at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, where captives in that war were kept, and where a woman named Captain Carolyn Wood was in charge of the interrogation. She was an MI, military intelligence captain. She was in charge of the interrogation there in the period of 2002 for about 6 months, during which at least three of the prisoners who were kept there were killed by being beaten to death by MP guards who were enforcing these new things. Nudity, stress positions, the use of dogs to exploit the fears of the prisoners, all of these things were used at Bagram Air Base. Well, in the summer of 2003, Captain Carolyn Wood arrived in Iraq and was stationed at Abu Ghraib, which was then being made into the interrogation center of Iraq. And when she was asked by her people, the soldiers under her command, well, what are the rules here? She started to draft rules. She discovered there were no rules. And so she started to draft rules, largely based on her experience in Afghanistan. And then she also got a hold of the rules of engagement of an outfit called Task Force 121, which was then called Task Force 20. But Task Force 20 and 121 were manhunt operations set up with basically no rules at all. Even the CIA agents who were in part embedded inside of it were told to carry absolutely no identification that they were Americans, so that if they died, it was unidentified bodies. And these were people who, for instance, killed Saddam Hussein's sons and his grandson, Uday and Qusay, and his grandson as well in the raid in late July, and they were pretty gloves-off outfit. She used some of their rules. She incorporated these things and started using them at Abu Ghraib. At the same time, General Miller, who was in charge of the interrogation regime at Guantanamo Bay. Now, Guantanamo Bay, again, remember, belongs to the Afghan theater. It's where almost all the people who are at Guantanamo Bay were captured in Afghanistan. So he is brought over, and he brings the rules that had just been signed off on in April of 2003 directly by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, which allowed a whole lot of techniques that were increasingly rough. There had been a rougher set of rules that allowed jabbing of prisoners, a sort of vague term that suggests poking people in the chest, and a lot of sleep deprivation, various physical stresses that had now been taken off the books, but with a line always that covered them that said, however, not, you know, any other techniques that you think are necessary, I will I will entertain. If you send me a note, I will approve or not approve them. So nothing was ever taken off the table. Things were put on the table, and then they were sort of put into this category of all you have to do is ask, which means that the idea had been introduced before it was slightly restricted, rather than saying there are certain things that are forbidden, and if you really, really need to do something and everything's forbidden, call me. That would be a different way of constructing it. But no, it was always a license was given and then slightly retracted. And if you just think about it, I mean, whether it's child rearing or running a bureaucracy, everybody knows that once you give license, it's a lot harder to take it away than if you've never given it in the first place. You've created a set of possibilities. You've created a set of habits. One of the civilian interrogators who served at Abu Ghraib said, you know, you have to understand, people arrived in Afghanistan for the first tour in the war, and they were told, you know, the gloves are coming off, we're softening things up, you can do what you need here. And by the time they left, you had naked prisoners. The next group arrived, and they were naked prisoners, and they're told the gloves are coming off. Well, what do? It gets accelerated from there. The third group that arrives, it's normal to have naked prisoners hanging from the rafters and wearing panties on their head. And they're told, you know, take it easy, but we're getting a little bit looser and rougher here. And so to them, what was the extreme that two groups had already reached has become the norm. Sabrina Harmon, who's one of the MPs who served at Abu Ghraib and appeared in and took some of the photographs that became so troubling and iconic, she had actually been aspiring to be a forensic photographer in civilian life, which is one of those sort of ironies of fate that is kind of amazing when you contemplate it. She had wanted to be a crime scene photographer, and she became one at Abu Ghraib. The scenes involved her own activities to some extent, but not only. And when she arrived at the prison, she said, you know, at first, when you see a prisoner standing there naked, you can't believe what you're seeing. And the next day you come in and you see a guy standing naked and he's chained up. And you think, well, it's not so bad just to be standing around naked. And the next day you come in and there's a naked guy standing there with a woman pointing at him and laughing and a dog barking at him. And you think, well, the other guy, what I saw yesterday wasn't so bad. And in this way you become incrementally inured. So what was happening on the large scale, policy-wise, was happening individually also with the soldiers. There's an important moment in this story, and I'm still, in a sense, in the backstory because I think it's crucial, which is the speech that was made off the shore here on May 1st of 2003 on the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln here off San Diego when President Bush came and declared the end of major combat in Iraq, and there was the famous Mission Accomplished banner. And that event was obviously much criticized for the fact that it was a kind of premature triumphalism, that here he was gloating and boasting at what obviously we now know was merely the beginning of the war. So how could he declare that it was basically over? But it's really worth getting past the swagger and the thumbs-up grinning president standing there with his troops and doing his photo op in full flight uniform and seeing what that speech said. I went back to read it while I was writing this book, and it's really striking because after the first paragraph and after the pageantry, there's a lot of language that seems to me to have been carefully crafted, not just by speechwriters, but by lawyers. There were lawyers underneath this language. And what it basically said is he didn't really talk about Iraq for very much of the talk. He talked about the war on terror. And he talked about Iraq as a single battle in the war on terror. And although he said mission accomplished and the banner, and that was from the White House, and although he said major combat is over, he made it clear that the war was not over, that the war would continue, and that it was continuing in Iraq. And at the same day, it turns out, and much quieter, barely mentioned anywhere in the press, Donald Rumsfeld was in Afghanistan, and he declared that major combat was over. Why this phrase? These guys don't throw terms around lightly. Everybody makes fun of them for being, you know, verbally deficient and somehow illiterate. They are not. They are highly skilled, and they are heavily lawyered up. And when they say things, they mean things. And they're delighted that people think that they're speaking gibberish because it means they're not paying attention. And nothing has been a greater service to the offenses committed against this nation in the name of this nation's security in the last 7 years, the wounds inflicted on this nation in the name of defending against a wound, than people not paying attention. And they basically were saying, this is the end of the conventional war. We are no longer fighting an army of a sovereign state. We are now fighting an unlawful combatant enemy. And over 8,000 prisoners who had been seized during the invasion between March and May were then released in the subsequent 6 to 8 weeks. By midsummer of 2003, all of these people who were technically POWs covered by the Geneva Convention were mostly released. A few were kept because they were seen as security threats. They and the increasingly large numbers of people who were being arrested were now categorized as security detainees. Security detainees is a term that had come into being during this war that had to do with a loophole in the Geneva Convention, which basically said, on the occasion of imperative military necessity, the occupying power may, and this is specifically about occupation, judge that spies and saboteurs may be held outside some of the protections for periods of time. They created from this an entire category. And into this category, they threw everybody they picked up in the country. By the time that the soldiers that we're concerned with arrived at Abu Ghraib, there were thousands of prisoners there, of whom, by the Army's own subsequent estimates, somewhere between 80 and 90% probably, were guilty of nothing whatsoever, had no involvement in the insurgency, and were merely picked up as a matter of opportunity during sweeps, of security sweeps of neighborhoods. They were either in the vicinity where an attack had taken place, or they were in the vicinity where soldiers had a coordinate saying, here's a suspect, there's a suspect, go find him. These soldiers would show up looking for a guy named Abdul, and there would be a lot of people named Abdul. Or Abdul would be having tea with 40 male relatives in his backyard, so they'd take all the relatives. They took kids as young as 10 years old. If they couldn't find the father, they'd take the kid. They'd tell the family, you know, we've got your kid. Send your father in, we'll let the kid go. This is illegal. It's called hostage taking. They were holding these people without charges, without necessarily informing their families, without any system for their release, and they were holding them in a combat zone. Abu Ghraib prison, which had been Saddam Hussein's great prison, was in the center of the Sunni triangle and was under constant bombardment. In the weeks before the MPs in this 372nd, who I write about, arrived, a mortar attack had not only killed many prisoners, but it also killed American interrogators who were at the prison. Doesn't warm the interrogators to their job to be told that the people that they're interrogating are the people who were trying to kill them yesterday and who killed their buddy. It increased the violence level. When they arrived, they found the prisoners naked. They found prisoners in panties. They found prisoners in stress positions. Sabrina Harmon started taking pictures, she said, because I wanted to show what was allowed. It's an interesting word, and it came up a number of times in her interview when she tried to describe it. It didn't seem like something she was falling back on like a talking point. It was more that when she would try to describe what shocked her and what she was responding to at the prison, she would say, what was allowed? And it struck me that it was a very good description of, in fact, what's so troubling is the license that was created. These soldiers didn't know that the policy was in place. They didn't know that Carolyn Wood's rules from Afghanistan and General Miller's rules by way of Rumsfeld from Guantanamo Bay had been brought to General Ricardo Sanchez, the commander of ground forces in Iraq, who's now, by the way, out shilling a book saying that he was a victim of Abu Ghraib, and that he had signed off on five different conflicting, but subsequently, you know, basically saying the same thing, sets of rules for interrogators, which all said, these are the things that are allowed. Exploiting the Arab fear of dogs by the use of dogs during interrogation, environmental and sleep manipulation, food manipulation, darkness, noise, all of the things that you see and hear about at Abu Ghraib, he and his lawyers signed off on. And what did they say when they said how these things should be implemented? They should be implemented by the MP guards who should be enlisted as instruments of the interrogators to create the conditions for a suitable interrogation to break the resistance of these suspects. That was the circumstances that they were brought into. And she starts taking these photographs. And what's very striking about the earliest photographs that were taken by these soldiers is they're not like the photographs that you know as the iconic photographs that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk. They're almost always much more journalistic. They just show a single prisoner. The first one shows a man with his hands tied behind his head, chained to a cell. He's naked. He has a pair of panties, women's panties on his head, and he's totally alone. They're some of the saddest pictures I've ever seen. They're just people turn into a kind of hellish statuary. And they also have the photojournalistic quality of a soldier walking down a prison hallway and going snap. Another soldier going snap, looking through bars of cells and simply photographing what they saw. These are the photographs that Sabrina wrote a series of letters home at the time to her wife, as she calls her, her partner back home, and described her own range of emotions. Walking in thinking that it was funny, finding herself laughing, finding herself joining in the mockery, simultaneously thinking, wait, it's molestation. Taking a photograph because, as she said, I wanted proof. If I saw these things and I told you about them, nobody would believe me. If I take a picture, there'll be proof. Charles Grainer, who's always been painted as the ringleader, said very similar things. He'd been in the Gulf War. He'd gone to the VA with problems. They hadn't believed his stories. So this time he brought a camera, and he told this to a number of people long before they arrived at Abu Ghraib. I'm going to photograph everything I see that's off the wall, everything that's strange. People are going to believe my war stories. There's something about Grainer that people don't believe. Grainer knew that. Grainer took pictures. Grainer was also self-dramatizing, and he started to introduce the idea of combining the pictures he liked to take of his friends posing in what they called happy snaps and the pictures with the prisoners. And those led to the pictures that are so confusing for us all, where you see the soldiers grinning, mugging in front of the bodies. But none of what they did, and this is important, one can sympathize and understand the situation very well by getting inside their heads without being all exculpating of them. Nothing that they did, if Grainer was a sadist and if others took pleasure, would have happened if it weren't the policy, if it weren't, as Sabrina said, allowed, if it weren't encouraged. At one point, Grainer used to like to take prisoners as they arrived with hoods on their head and walk them into walls. He would just steer them along, bang, into a wall. So as he one day was walking a prisoner into a wall and blood began to come out from under his hood, there was a JAG lawyer standing there, and there was his captain, a man named Brinson, who works actually in Congress as a liaison to the Armed Services Committee for a conservative Republican from the South. He was there, and he realized that because there were these lawyers there, it might be best to fill out some paperwork. He filled out the paperwork, and it's an extraordinary document because it basically says, look, you know, we know what a terribly difficult and challenging and tense situation you're in, and you're doing a terrific job. Military intelligence's crucial mission in this war is being served very, very well by you, and you've been often, you know, sort of commended for that. It was supposed to be something in the vein of a reprimand, a counseling statement, a bit of a warning, a shot across the bow, take it easy, soldier. And it came out as what one of the other soldiers described as a pure attaboy. You're doing what you're supposed to do. They used the photographs also within the prison to show their higher-ups and say, what do you think about this? In some cases, Grainer showed photographs to medics. In the case of Lindy England holding the guy on the leash, he said, is it okay if we use tie-down straps, because it's not a leash? If we use tie-down straps like this with some of our mentally ill patients, they had inmates who were mentally ill and really barking mad and thrashing like a sort of Victorian bedlam. They were responsible for them as well, and totally untrained for any of this, I should add. And medics looked at these pictures and said, under the circumstances, sure. This has been written up in the New England Journal of Medicine. So to telegraph through this story, when we get towards the moment that we're in where the soldiers' pictures come out and we all are in shock, and all the politicians in Washington go to Capitol Hill and say, this is disgusting, these disgusting depraved soldiers, these disgusting, disgusting, and act as if it's simply these few who somehow did it on their own, these depraved bad apples on the night shift. Our antenna went up enough that we had magazine covers like that Economist cover that says, this goes to the top. But we were all too willing and all too comfortable, I think, and I count myself to hope that these pictures weren't of us. They weren't of our policy. They weren't of something being done in our name. They didn't implicate us as well. And they weren't things that were being done in the name of our freedoms and our security, but they were people who'd gone off the reservation. Command system in the military would not allow that. And if it did, shouldn't that be itself the offense? It would be outrageous if the commanders of America's top military prison in Iraq allowed the things that we see in these pictures and what we find out is going on beyond these pictures, to be happening night after night after night with what they called the highest value detainees in an insurgency that was threatening to overcome a very crucial campaign in a war on terror. We don't know what this war is about at this point. We're told now that the president said it was just his gut. It sounds as good an explanation as any of those that were given and haven't held up. What we do know is that whatever else it was about the projection of American force and the projection of America's image into the world. How were we going to see ourselves and present ourselves and convey ourselves to the world? And in some ways, these images became that. And that couldn't have possibly happened in a system of command responsibility that the Army runs on had that not been going to the highest level. And so by looking, I realize I give this talk, it sounds like a policy talk. When I tell the story, I tell it very much through the voices of these soldiers that I described. And when you get to the end, they're really quite angry. And at times they sound like they're making excuses, that they're self-exculpating. At times they are. Many of them did time. Sabrina Harmon did a year in prison for taking pictures. One of the sets of pictures that she took that were famous, Peter sort of mentioned in his introduction, there's a photograph of her smiling and giving a thumbs up next to a corpse of a prisoner. We all got upset about the smile and the thumb. But the corpse was a prisoner who had died under interrogation during an interrogation by a CIA interrogator 16 hours earlier in that shower and cell where those photographs were taken. And she, as a forensic photographer, had walked in there late at night and taken a series of photographs, there are about 20 of them, where she starts to peel back the ice bags that he'd been packed in when they were trying to figure out how to dispose of and cover up the corpse, peeled back band-aids that had been put on to make it look like he'd had medical treatment, even though the medical treatment was subsequent to his death. And those are the only photographs that we have that give us evidence that a man was murdered there, and murdered we know because subsequently we find that a week later the Army had issued an autopsy which declared his death a homicide. The man who was in the cell with him, the interrogator, a CIA agent named Swanner, has been identified and has never been charged, nor has anybody ever been charged in the death of this man. But the photograph taking became something that was considered an offense. And I think that's really important, because trying to understand how we've responded to this, the act of taking photographs has gotten confused with the acts that they depict. We've thought it's perverse. We've thought it's unaccountable. We've thought it's so stupid to be so self-incriminating that they must be completely amoral and depraved. Maybe they didn't think that they were being self-incriminating. Maybe they thought that they were recording a system that they were part of, that was beyond them, that was around them. Maybe that is what's going on. And I want to end very quickly by just reading a little passage to give you a sense, because it's the only way I can really get it across, of the store of the voices. And that is, I thought I'd read you a passage from Lindy England looking back. She got 3 years in prison. She was not an MP, technically speaking, as a guard. She was merely over at this high-value detention military intelligence block by virtue of being the girlfriend of Charles Grainer. She would go over there at night and hang out with him. And she then got 3 years in prison for having appeared in the photographs and been around at the time. A lot of people, when they talk to me and they see what I've been through, they think that I should be this fragile little person that's about to jump at every twig that breaks, Lindy England said. But I'm not like that. I don't think about it. If I think about it, it's overwhelming. It's too much to think about all the stuff that I've went through. So that's what calms me. I don't think about it. I think about something else, read a book, watch a movie, whatever. Sometimes I have nightmares. I don't even talk to my psychiatrist about them. I don't want to talk about them ever. What's it going to help to talk about it besides reliving it? There's no point in doing that. I don't want to do that. Because guess what? Don't laugh. Thoughts cause emotions. If I don't think about it, I'm not going to feel anything. If I don't think about it, then it doesn't happen. So that's what I do. I don't think about anything. I don't want to relive or feel. That's why I take medicine, so I don't have the nightmares. I take antidepressant, anxiety pills. That and usually my son wears me out. On the rare occasion that I forget to take my medicine, I usually have nightmares. When that guy was screaming in the shower, I hear that in the middle of the night. It'll wake me up, freak me out. It's always going to be there. The way he was screaming, it was just a death scream. He was just screaming at the top of his lungs constantly. And you're right in the next room. It's like it's vibrating your whole body, it's so loud. I don't think I'll ever get that out of my head. I just want to go on with life, get a job, raise my son. Now I'm going to be trying to save money for him to go to college. I don't think I have a lot of choices. It's going to be hard for me to get a job because now I have a felony on my record. Plus, you know, people don't want the publicity. The way I feel right now in my own country, to walk down the street, I'm still scared because there's just people that are behind me and there's people that hate me. They feel like we shouldn't have been doing that or we were being inhumane or whatever their opinion is. I've even gotten hate mail about it. At least when I was in Iraq, I knew who the enemy was. Here I don't. Even though I'm in my own country, I can never get away from it. I go out, I go to Walmart, I go shopping, but it's like I'm always watching my back. I don't like to walk in public. I don't like to walk down the street. I don't like to walk into a room that's crowded because it feels like everyone is staring at me. And people do. When I'm shopping for food or something, I got my son with me and I'm concentrating on him, but I know people are staring at me. They know it's me, but that's just my hometown. Some other big town, I probably wouldn't walk down the street because I don't know what kind of people they are. I don't know if they're for me or against me. I don't want to take the risk. All I did was what I was told to do. I didn't make the war. I can't end the war. I mean, photographs can't just make or change a war. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, how do people see me as the villain? The government is just putting the blame on me because they can, just like a decoy. I can't get mad. I mean, I'm over it. I'm fine. I mean, I'm not fine with it, but whatever. It's how the world turns, ain't it? People backstabbing other people, unfairness, drama. It's life. You live it. Learn from your mistakes. I learned from mine. It's like I don't need a man to survive. Forget him. It's like every situation that I come into now, I take a step back instead of rushing head first. I look at the consequences ahead of time. Before, I just do it. It's just part of being young and naive, I guess. For me, the moment that changed me was meeting Grainer. If I wasn't involved with Grainer, I wouldn't have been in that situation. Therefore, I wouldn't have been in the pictures. I probably would have known it was going on, but I wouldn't have been involved, and I wouldn't have therefore went to prison or been the poster girl for this war. Don't cry. Hell, I ain't cried over it. Can't change anything, and if I did, then I wouldn't have Carter. I mean, I wouldn't trade him for the world. Carter was her son with Grainer. So I wouldn't want to go back and change anything. I mean, yeah, I was in pictures that showed me holding a leash around the guy's neck, but that's all I did. I was convicted of being in a picture. So if I'm a villain by standing in a picture, I mean, I've never heard of that before. I'd be happy to take your questions. Will anyone be held criminally liable for what happened? Who, how? About a dozen low-level soldiers have been held criminally liable for what happened. The lowest of the low, reservist MPs under the rank, up to the rank of staff sergeant. Will anybody higher ever be held criminally liable? I would be surprised. It would be nice to think that at some point there will at least be some kind of accounting and hearings that would attempt to get to the bottom of this and understand how we got here. Some careers have been ruined in the military, as it were, by this without criminal sanction. People who were the colonel who was in charge of Abu Ghraib's military intelligence operation, who don't get promoted, who suddenly get sidelined, but they also got protected and covered up and kept away from court-martials. They see themselves as scapegoats. I see themselves as people who got away with something. They got away without criminal prosecution. They ended up in this position that we're in now, where a whole series of policies, and it's not limited to Abu Ghraib, it goes on to this day. There was an article in the New York Times this week that of the 21,000 people still in American custody in detention in Iraq, and I can tell you that some of those people are the people who were in Abu Ghraib at the time that these offenses happened in 2003. We know that. Of those 21,000 people, recently cut from 29,000, the general in charge of detention thinks that at least 60% of them have no reason to be held as a threat to our security. And yet there they are. And they've been there for years. And at Bagram Air Force Base, we've got another 20 to 25,000. These are outrageous offenses. This is not a story in the past. People sometimes say to me when about this book, do you think people really want to hear about this? And is there anything new? And I say, I'm not sure people want to hear about this. I'm quite aware of the very legitimate resistances that people have to sort of digging into this dark hole. But it's not behind us. It's not something from the past. So whether people are held accountable or not, I hope that we have an accounting. Because it seems to me that at least at this stage, having only the very lowest level little guys go to jail as a kind of papering over of a massive offense to our traditions, traditions that go back to George Washington's treatment of prisoners in the Revolution, where he said, the British kill our prisoners as policy on the battlefield, that's their law. We shall not do the same to their unfortunate brethren when they fall into our hands. And British and Hessian soldiers who were taken prison by us stayed in this country after the Revolution because of that. And foreign aid came to the Revolution because of that. And Abraham Lincoln said, military imperative never means cruelty. These are traditions deep, deep in us. John McCain said when he was under torture in Hanoi during the Vietnam War, what kept him going was the knowledge that we don't do this to our prisoners. And now he signed on for waterboarding because the political vote was going that way at that moment. When I say the national honor's at stake, that's what I mean by disgrace. And when I say that it's un-American to have the littlest guys out there swinging in the wind for this, I mean it in a sort of John Capra movie sense. That's not kind of who we are. And it seems that the punishment, frankly, has been in its own way as un-American as the offenses that started it. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.